Good morning. Several years ago, I was in D.C. for some meetings and paid a visit to a local friend and research colleague of mine and now business partner, Melissa. When we came up to a stoplight, a middle-aged bald man zips past us in a souped-up red convertible sports car with the top down. Melissa chuckles and comments, "Ha! There goes a midlife crisis." I paused. You do realize the irony here, right? You've got the two of us who decided to go back to work on PhDs at our age and at our points in our careers. We're in the throes of these esoteric dissertations, mine on meaningful work and yours on team humility. I mean, who in their right mind does that? "Yeah, good point," she mutters dejectedly as she acknowledges, "I guess I'm just jealous because his midlife crisis looks a lot simpler, cheaper, and more fun than ours." Confession time. For over a decade, I had contemplated going back and getting a PhD. And if I'm being honest about it, it was largely because I was bored and wanted a challenge. Or as I would often joke, it was to stave off the brain rot. Or as I call it, pursuing this path in my life doesn't qualify for a midlife existential crisis of sorts, then I don't know what does. I completed this midlife crisis, aka my PhD, in the summer of 2018 after three of the most intense years of my life. It was a full-time executive doctoral program for working professionals with advanced degrees that was offered through the Center for Values-Driven Leadership from Benedictine University. During this period, I was also working my former full-time job of over 10 years as a director of consulting with the SAS Institute, serving state and local government agencies, public health care agencies, and K-12 and higher education institutions, while also working adjunctly at Bethany and serving as a visiting professor for a corporate strategy and international business program at a college in Mexico. So out of necessity, as I was feverishly working to reinvent myself, while all the metaphorically driving this car that we were still driving, I became a recluse in regards to just about everything else. My course of study centered on the concepts of values-driven leadership, corporate social responsibility, and sustainability. My dissertation research focused on the exploration of meaningful work, work meaningfulness, and specifically what organizations can do to help cultivate the conditions that foster greater meaningfulness for employees, as well as what individuals can do for themselves to experience greater work meaningfulness. One thing I became convinced of through this midlife crisis is that the more I learned, the more I realized, the less I knew. Funny how that works. And as unsettling as that was for me initially in this process, I've made peace with it now on this side of the experience. But for as much as I joke about this whole experience being a midlife crisis of sorts, these efforts were truly labors of love for me. When Anna asked me if I would consider preaching, I consented to doing so with the caveat that I would not attempt to undertake a scriptural exegesis. But I also want to honor relevant themes found in today's readings. So as we take a look at the scripture references today, I'm going to focus on the aspects related to purposeful labor. And I'd like to share some of what I encountered with you today with regards to meaningful, purpose-driven work as we ponder some questions together. If I do my job well, I'm going to provoke some thought in a new or different way by asserting some positions that you may not necessarily agree with. Here are the seven position statements which we'll explore today. First, work-life balance is an ill-conceived notion. Whoever said, "If you find something you are passionate about, you will never work a day in your life," could not have been further from the truth. In reality, there is no such thing as an ideal job. Yoga can be bad for your health. Job descriptions are meant to be broken. Pursuing your calling can have a dark side. And meaningful work is an ethical issue. Now let's take a look at each of these briefly. Work-life balance is an ill-conceived notion. The average working adult spends half of their waking hours at work. The concept of work-life balance implies a binary opposition between the two. You're either working or you're living, and it's a competition between the two. If you think about it, it's a pretty morbid way to consider our time at work. A healthier perspective is to consider the construct of work-life integration. This way of thinking allows us to take a more holistic perspective on the work, home and family, community, personal well-being, spiritual, and health aspects of our lives. Certainly, when we are at work and consider the ways we can fulfill the larger purposes than ourselves, solve problems, serve others, build relationships, enjoy moments, we are living. And certainly, each one of us needs to care for our own personal, spiritual, emotional, physical, and familial well-being. How we integrate these aspects throughout our days will look different for each one of us. And it will invariably look different for us even on any given day. It's important to be mindful of how we integrate all the various aspects of our lives together, because everything we do up until the point of our death is living. We don't, or at least we shouldn't, pause living when we go to work. Optimally, we'll find work that we love doing. But even if we are in a job that primarily provides for sustenance, I think it's we do ourselves a disservice when we hold on to the perspective of trying to achieve work-life balance. If this is a new concept to you, I encourage you to try on the concept of work-life integration for size. And while we're on the topic of trying to find work we love, that brings me to my second assertion. Whoever said if you find something you're passionate about, you will never work a day in your life could not have been more wrong. In a podcast I was recently listening to entitled How to Get a Grip by Matthew Kimberly, geared for entrepreneurs, one of his guests, Martha Kimberly, rips on this concept as a total myth. In fact, quite the opposite is true. She astutely asserts that if you follow your passion, you will likely work more than you ever have worked in your life. I'm probably a poster child for this phenomenon, but she goes on to add that a lot of it will be very fun. While well-intentioned, the advice for people to just follow their passions can actually be quite frustrating for people on a number of levels. First, many struggle to truly discern what they're passionate about in the first place. Or perhaps they struggle to figure out how to make a living from their passion. Many have multiple passions, and deciding where to focus their energies can be a daunting proposition. When we internalize this notion that it's supposed to be a simple formula, we can be left to feel inadequate by this false expectation that is created, that things should come easily and that every day should be great. That simply isn't how it works. Life is a messy proposition. One of the hats I wear now is an instructor and career coach for full-time MBA students in Notre Dame's graduate business program, where our distinctive is growing the good in business. I see these hidden assumptions about pursuing one's passions rear their head in almost daily conversations with these graduate students. And I think we do our youth a disservice when we perpetuate comments like this. While I absolutely encourage discerning and follow your passions, it's important to also understand the role that persistence and challenge will play in one's experience. That's also part of the journey. Dozens of my students are about to embark on their business on the front lines experience across the globe in the coming weeks, which is a bit like Goshen's SST program. In a more condensed period of time, where teams go on to work with local NGOs and community members on targeted needs, often in war-torn regions, to create sustainable solutions to complex business and societal challenges. As many in this room can attest, this type of work is complex, messy, and frustrating. Yet despite all the inherent messiness and challenges that these situations pose, these transformational learning opportunities quite often become the highlights of many students' experiences. As another everyday example, I know countless teachers in our midst and beyond who are passionate about their work. We can also attest that they have to contend with many significant challenges that would never be expected to be tolerated in other professional settings. While in these situations, one can experience a deep sense of purpose, moments of joy, and significant appreciation when conditions are ripe, pursuing one's passion or calling is a double-edged sword, to be sure. I'll say more about that in a bit. The message of following our passions and leaning into our gifts or our strengths is a good one, provided we keep in perspective that this doesn't negate the hard work and persistence we'll also need to accompany these pursuits. This brings me to my next point, that in reality, there is no such thing as a perfect job. While the notion of a perfect job may exist in our minds, there is no such thing in reality. Every job comes with its share of challenges. That's why it's called work, after all. One of my early mentors would often say to us when the going would get tough that just remember, if it was easy, they wouldn't need us. However, the more attuned we are to our own gifts and passions, and the more closely we can work to find the best fit with the job, seeking to minimize the gaps between our theoretical ideals we hold in a job and the realities, the more meaningful we will find our work. I think that a good place to start is by taking a look at our problems, i.e. the job opportunities, for which the world needs solutions, and discern opportunities that leverage a good number of your gifts and passions. And while I would assert that there's no utopia or no perfect job, I do believe that it is possible to find a place of ikigai, which is a Japanese concept that loosely translates to a reason for being, or to some, the reason to get up in the morning. If you take a look at this Venn diagram, you'll see four circles, clockwise, from left to right. What you are good at, what you love, what the world needs, and what you can get paid for. From a work perspective, the sweet spot, obviously, is ikigai. It's in the center where they all intersect. Each of the other intersections has associated trade-offs, which are noted accordingly. I'll pause for a moment so you can reflect for yourself on where you might currently find yourself sitting in this model. I will say, don't fret if you don't find yourself sitting in ikigai. This comes back to my original assertion. While it can be helpful to understand theoretically what this can look like and can help us be mindful of where we see ourselves sitting and why, bear in mind also that meaningfulness is episodic. What this means, experiencing work meaningfulness, ikigai, the zone, whatever we want to call it, is an ongoing journey, a constantly balancing equilibrium, not a destination that one can achieve. On this point, it brings me to my next provocative assertion, that yoga can be bad for your health. Allow me to provide further context. One of my colleagues who served on my dissertation committee, Mario Lips-Wiersma, developed a model of meaningful work based upon her years of research. The first time I was exposed to her model, I remember her quipping that yoga's great. I love yoga. But if all I ever did was yoga, that wouldn't amount to a very meaningful existence. Her point is that we need to be in balance between being and doing, and in balance between self and others. She identifies four dimensions of work meaningfulness that she puts in a quadrant, as shown here, moving clockwise left to right. Simply put, the integrity with self quadrant represents the extent to which one can feel like they can be their true selves at work. If I have to put on facades for my authentic self at work, this will negatively impact my experience of work meaningfulness. Unity with others, the next quadrant, represents the extent to which we feel in harmony in our work with others. As Paul writes in his letter to Corinth, he calls for people to realize that we are God's servants, serving a common purpose. The extent to which we can experience this realization and feel this at work will contribute to our sense of work meaningfulness. The next quadrant is service to others. Fairly self-evident here, the extent to which we feel like our work serves others will contribute to our sense of work meaningfulness. The fourth quadrant, expressing our full potential, refers to the extent to which we feel like we can fully tap our gifts and potential in work. The more significantly we can do so, the more meaningful our work will feel. And of course, the converse for each of these is also true. The less we experience each of these dimensions, the less meaningful we will experience our work to be. The quadrants all center on our source of inspiration. Just as each person's perceptions, experiences are personalized for each of the four quadrants, so is their source of inspiration, be it from a spiritual core, a deeper sense of purpose or calling. For some, it may be their family or some other aspect that inspires them. Each of these dimensions is held in balance on the axes of self and others and being and doing. And all these dimensions are constrained by the realities of self and circumstances. And speaking of the realities of self and circumstances, let me offer my next assertion. Job descriptions are meant to be broken. Okay, I'll admit this statement is an attempt to be a little bit edgy and push the envelope a bit. I won't necessarily make this argument literally or unilaterally, but I will definitely assert that job descriptions should at least be flexed where it makes sense. Let me tell you a quick story to illustrate my point. In 2001, University of Michigan professor Jane Dutton and Yale professor Amy Wyrzynski embarked on a now famous study in the field to explore how people in unglamorous jobs coped with their work. They initially set out to interview hospital janitorial staff at a major Midwest hospital. What they found took them by surprise and charted a new trajectory and proliferation of decades of subsequent research. As they interviewed staff, all of whom had identical job descriptions, they came across a group of cleaners who didn't view themselves as part of the cleaning staff at all. In fact, these employees viewed their roles as part of the professional staff that was integral to the patient's healing. This perspective was a game changer. Employees with this perspective would get to know the patients and their families personally. They offered them support in small but significant ways. They offered words of encouragement to patients and family members. They brought them items of care, food and beverage items, tissues, etc. They talked to comatose patients and rearranged pictures on the wall from time to time in the hopes that the change in scenery might have some sort of positive effect on their recovery. The participants in this research study who did these things often were outside the bounds of their written job description and could have even potentially been reprimanded by superiors at work for these additional duties which they adopted. Yet, as you might guess, the employees who experienced their work in this manner experienced higher degrees of work meaningfulness. Dutton and Rzhinsky coined the term job crafting from this practice. In essence, what this means is that people can take their core job descriptions and tailor them around the edges to be more personally engaging, serve a higher purpose, or add additional value to their teammates, their customers, or their organization. The research and practical implications have been very significant for me personally and professionally the past few decades. So it was a great joy and honor to get to know Amy personally when I met her at a conference several years back and after she agreed to serve on my dissertation committee. Amy has also done a significant amount of research on the calling as well, which is the next point I want to make. Pursuing your calling can have a dark side. When pursuing something that you might view as your calling, this can be a double-edged sword. As I mentioned previously, while pursuing one's passion can indeed be a source of great joy and can also be a source of a significant frustration. Organizations, unfortunately, will sometimes take advantage of people in these situations and roles. This is particularly prevalent in not-for-profit institutions where sometimes the implicit or even explicit insinuation is that employees should put up with inequalities or substandard conditions simply because they're pursuing what is considered a calling. One need not look further than the way teachers are often treated in our society as a whole. As individuals, it's important to be mindful of this potential dynamic and set appropriate boundaries and seek to put your own proverbial oxygen mask on first before tending to the needs of others. But ultimately, this is also an organizational ethics issue, and that could be a whole sermon unto itself, but for sake of brevity, we'll move on to the final broader point I want to make, which is that meaningful work is an ethical issue. Ethically speaking, organizations should strive to create and support environments that are conducive to cultivating work meaningfulness. This passion of mine led me to one of my other hats that I wear in this chapter of my postdoc career. I co-founded Ad Lucem Group with a friend and colleague, Melissa, from my doctoral program. Ad Lucem is Latin for to the light and represents our firm's commitment to helping organizations generate and implement holistic strategy while also mindfully accounting for the well-being of the individuals within organizations. There is a whole collection of ethical considerations in regards to work meaningfulness with research and practitioners alike are currently wrestling. Some of these questions include, how do individuals in diverse cultures and society negotiate the worthiness of their work? Do organizations have a moral obligation to provide meaningful work? And do people have a moral duty to perform meaningful work? What are the ethical implications when people seek meaningful work for which there's an insufficient market? Do employers take advantage of employees who feel like their work is meaningful? How will changes in the conditions of work, e.g. technology, workplace environment, and generational shifts influence the ethical issues of an individual, ethical issues and priority of meaningful work? What is the responsibility of an individual and or an organization for sustaining a meaningful career? And what moral obligations do organizations have towards helping individuals to develop and sustain a more meaningful career trajectory? A sermon could admittedly be devoted to each one of these questions, and up until this point, for the sake of time, I haven't even broached the topic of those who struggle to even find work for a myriad of potential reasons. I realize that my own research, personal perspective, and experience comes from a perspective of privilege, and as such is limited. Yet despite these and many other limitations, I also realize that I have gifts that are unique to me, as we all do. One of my gifts that I've come to recognize is that of making connections, be it through people, resources, and or translating ideas to action. I want to close with a final story from this past week, where I was able to mobilize this gift and share it as an encouragement to action in how we look for opportunities to mobilize our own unique gifts in this broken world of ours. Last week, I had the opportunity to watch a production entitled Heartless at the South Bend Civic Theater. What is particularly unique about this experience was that it was written and produced by a now former prisoner in collaboration with four other inmates. They chronicled key aspects of their life stories, including their own significant faith transformations and their newfound calling to share their story with others as a means to break down walls in our community and also to prevent at-risk youth from following in a similar path. Following the show, there was a significant community talkback session that followed. As they shared their stories, I was moved by the simple reminder that for many, merely having access to work and the associated dignity, not to mention the livelihood it supports, is an extreme challenge. I was also incredibly moved by what these five men have created, their story, their commitment to one another, their commitment to the community, and their deep sense of calling and common purpose to go out into the community, to be vulnerable, and to tell their story in order to reach at-risk youth and to help them avoid their plight. This has been a labor of love for them on multiple levels. And as I reflect upon our Psalms reading for today, I can't think of a more fitting story in their commitment to following God with their whole heart, walking in God's ways, the new joy and hope that have subsequently received, despite the many challenges that remain. And at the end of the day, their poignant calling out to God and to community not to be forsaken. I'd already been in conversations with the South Bend Civic Theater on some strategic planning and board governance support the week prior, and I experienced a deep sense of personal calling last week when I serendipitously came across a grant opportunity through Notre Dame Center for Social Concerns that would permit the production team of Heartless to expand their work and community outreach and allow for further research on a number of related social justice issues. So I unexpectedly spent last week in preparing and submitting a grant on their behalf for their continued work and sharing these efforts with them when I had the opportunity to meet them in person. I don't know what, if anything, will come from this grant application, but I hope it can serve as a reminder, though we are imperfect people that can only take imperfect action, we still have the power to affect a positive sea change in this world when we are tuned with our own personal gifts that we can contribute to various labors of love in our communities of faith, our work environments, and the community and society at large. This is particularly true when we can focus our efforts together, as Paul encourages the Church of Corinth to unite in common purpose. And this is as important as ever in today's climate. May it be so. Amen.